This is the Wildlife and Natural Resources Florida's Iconic Critters panel. You're all aware of who the panelists are, I'm sure. I'll do a brief introduction before we start. My name is Ari Odzer. If you're not local, I'm a local television news reporter. I've been covering news in South Florida for about 20 years, and just about every kind of environmental story I've covered, from slogging through swamps with Dr. Mazzotti to coral reefs issues to manatee issues, Florida panther issues, big cypress swamp buggy issues. Covered a lot of stuff, but we're here today to talk about these specific animals that you see listed in your program, and we have a distinguished panel of experts to talk about them. So hopefully you all will hear some updated information on these animals and the status of these species, and we're gonna do this with letting each panel member speak for about 10 minutes, and at the end we'll open it up for all the questions you guys have. And we're going to start with Dr. Sara Frias-Torres, who is an expert on fish, and specifically, we're going to talk about the Goliath grouper.
Okay, so I need to stand up and talk. Is that possible?
Absolutely. Just take the microphone off and talk into the microphones.
All right, so I'll try not to break the table, but... Yeah, I need all the leeway. Right, this is when I start singing.
TV guys are good with microphones.
All right, thank you very much. I'm going to be journalist friendly, so I'll give you a story, and I'll give you two news break stories. Hopefully somebody will pick it up on those. I'm a marine biologist, and I do all my research underwater. So the best way to understand the Goliath grouper is that we all go together and we go scuba diving right now. So let's get our gear together. We're going to get a small camera with a wide-angle lens. So there's no zooming here. So if the image looks big, you can pull out your arm and you can touch it. That's what we're going to be doing. So let's get all the gear together. Let's get the regulator together. And we're just going to go and... Dive. We are in the water right now, and we're meeting the gentle giant. This is the Goliath grouper, also known as Jewfish. Scientific name, Epinephalus itahara. Itahara means the lord of the rocks, and it makes reference to the huge size of this fish and to its charismatic and gentle nature. They're extremely curious to divers. They will never run away from you. Now, in the old days, before the extinction happened, the largest Goliath grouper was 7 feet long. That's 2.5 meters. Record weight was half a ton. We already killed those big guys. They don't exist anymore. Throughout this distribution area, tropical and subtropical Atlantic, the Goliath grouper is critically endangered. That is the step just before extinction. In the southeastern United States, the Goliath grouper was fished to near extinction in the late 1980s, and then a federal and state fishing ban started in 1990. So the reasons are always the same, overfishing and habitat destruction. Now, Florida is a very magic place because thanks to this moratorium and thanks to the fact that in Florida there are still mangroves, red mangrove, fringing red mangrove in the 10,000 islands, in the Florida Keys. And the Goliath grouper use those mangroves for the babies. It's the kindergarten of the Goliath grouper. That's where the babies stay until they are about 8 years old, and then they move to the reef, which is the adult habitat. So Florida has this moratorium and these mangroves, and because of that, it's a magic place, because it's the only place in the world today where you can go and dive and see these groupers every year round. But you can also see something very, very special, which is a spawning aggregation. And I'm going to be showing you through the rest of the video two spawning aggregation sites that are located in Jupiter, north from Miami. And the best way is, what is a spawning aggregation? You will ask me, you should ask me that. And I'm going to tell you what it is. Let's say you are a female Goliath grouper. You are all now a female Goliath grouper. And you are in your coral reef house in the Florida Keys. And then the month of August comes, and you say, I have an urge for sex. I'm going to do something about it. So you start doing a migration, a very long migration. It's going to be up to 100 miles, whatever it takes. And you're going to go to one of these spawning sites of Jupiter. And you know the migratory path because you took that trip before, a long time ago. You're learning from your elders. And you arrive to the site, and you see other Goliath groupers like you. And you say, well, here, we're going to have some fun. So you change your color because you have to show them you're a female. And you turn very, very light color. And then you see other Goliath groupers that are telling you they're males. So they turn really, really, really dark. Or maybe they have a white head and a dark body. So each one is saying, I'm a female. Or they will be saying, I'm a male. And then suddenly you find these really cool males. They start swimming next to you. They start doing this courtship. They swim sideways, you know, next to you. And they start booming. Sweet nothings to you. They start going boom, 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 boom. So you find this guy is really, really interesting. And here comes the full moon. Here comes the night. Here comes the full moon. And then you're telling them, I'm so ready to go. You know, you roll over. You show your big belly full of eggs. And you're telling the mouse, I'm so ready to go. And the mouse starts booming really strong. Boom to you. 160 decibels. That's the energy of a jet engine. And they're telling you, let's do it, baby. So you just swim and swim. You go up in the water column. You go all together. And suddenly, the eggs and the sperm come out, and then the eggs get fertilized, and the eggs drift in the ocean currents, and then the little baby fish, they will come out, they will get into the mangroves, and they will stay there for the next 8 years of their life until they go into the reef habitat. And then you are just this big female, you are all happy, and you just release all your eggs, and you say to the other males, honey, I have a headache, I'm going home. So you migrate all the way back to your coral reef home. And then you wait until the next year, same thing, you know, next time. And that's a spawning aggregation. Okay? All right. Now.
I just had to say that.
Yes.
Not that this isn't family friendly, but we had, okay. we had a complaint from the room next door that we were too loud, so.
Well,
before they call the cops on us, I'm going to try to turn
it. It was a spawning aggregation. I mean, I can hide the fact that it was a spawning aggregation. All right, so besides having so much fun doing my research, one of the things I found is that Goliath groupers, they generate an ecosystem of their own. In a way, they're so big, you see these little bait fish swimming around them. They use them as a refuge. And then the jacks have a much better opportunity to go chasing after the little bait fish. So in a way, you have such a big fish that it generates its own weather. And there's a whole food chain depending on the Goliath grouper. So can anybody hear me? Because I can hear myself now. All right. So now let's go and talk about something that it was shown in the little booklet. It says that the moratorium is controversial. Let me show you this because you're going to be seeing a female that is going to be doing some flashing. So the female is a pale color that is showing off right now. Hold on. And she's going to be rolling over, showing her big belly. See her big belly? And she's saying, I'm ready, baby. So, you see? Anyhow. The issue is this. Some people say the moratorium is controversial. All the science shows that Goliath grouper have not recovered yet from the commercial extinction event of the late 1980s. They have not recovered yet. They're in a very slow path to recovery, but they are not there yet. And in fact, it will take many, many years to be recovered, and I think it will never happen, actually, and that's for a number of reasons, and somebody can ask me about those reasons. Anyhow, a number of fishermen, they say that Goliath groupers are a pest, that they should be thinned out, that the moratorium should be lifted, because Goliath groupers are eating all the lobsters and all the groupers and snappers in the reef. That's what they're telling you, therefore they should be killed. All right. So scientists have known for quite some time that Goliath groupers feed on two different groups. They eat invertebrates, so that's your octopus and shellfish and crabs and worms and nasty slimy things you find in the sand, which you don't want to know, and then they eat some lobster, all right? So that's one thing. But they also eat on slow-moving poisonous fish. So you have fish with spines, poisonous spines like catfish and stingrays, and then you have fish that have terribly poisonous skin like pufferfish and cowfish and so forth. They don't chase after groupers and snappers and any other fish. They just don't do it. They can't do it. So if we see the stocks of groupers and snappers and other reef fish going down, don't blame it on the groupers, on the goliath groupers. Blame it on ourselves. Blame it on overfishing. Now, about the lobsters, yes, goliath grouper eat some lobsters, but that is part of a general diet. And in fact, there are 26 different species of animals in Florida that eat lobster. We are number 27. So here's the point. If eating lobster is a reason for killing something, we'll have to get rid of a lot of the diversity in Florida, starting with flipper. By the way, dolphins eat lobster. In my research, here's the news break. In my research, I found that digging out into the food web, that in fact the poisonous fish that goliath grouper feed on, they are in turn predators of baby lobster. So if you have goliath groupers, you do what's called a top-down control, because goliath groupers are feeding on the predators of baby lobsters, therefore they give baby lobsters a chance to grow and become big. Right? So if you do that, ironically, the same lobster fishermen that blame the goliath groupers for not having enough lobsters, in fact, the more goliath groupers you have, the better chances you have of having lobsters to put on your dinner table. And the other news break I just want to tell you is that a goliath grouper today is worth more money alive than dead. And this is part of the research that I'm doing, but my preliminary results show that a lot of people come from all over the state, all over the country, all over the world, just to go scuba diving with this goliath grouper, with these spawning aggregations. And in fact, my first calculations show that in one spawning season, which lasts for 2 months pretty much, is September and October, one dive business located in Florida can make up to $500,000. This is money that gets into the local community, sustains local jobs, is sustainable as long as we have the goliath groupers alive. So that's all I have to say for my 10 minutes. And if you have any questions, I'm here for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Next up is Paul Gray, sitting to my left. He's from Audubon of Florida. And Paul was going to talk about flamingos, but everyone kind of decided, hey, we don't really have flamingos in Florida. So it's iconic in name only.
Yeah, we have plastic flamingos.
Can you speak into a mic?
We have plastic flamingos and theme park flamingos. But so what I'm going to talk about is the Everglades snail kite. It's an iconic Florida bird. It's in North America. It's only found in the Everglades region. And the first one that was ever found was in the 1840s. And for those of you who flew into the Miami airport, that's about exactly where it was shot. And if that didn't look like Everglades habitat to you now, that's part of what we're going to talk about. Okay, this bird is a hawk. It's specialized to eat snails. This is a male. This is a female. I brought some show and tell here. Here's an apple snail, and this is all this bird eats. This is all, and it's got this little door on its shell, and that very hooked bill can get in behind the door and unhook the connector muscle and pop the snail out, and they eat them. And I'll pass a few around for show and tell part of this. I brought them along. So.
If you thought you were getting extra points for show and tell, forget it.
Yeah, well.
You might get a gold star. That's it.
We're working on it. And so this is an exotic apple snail. I just got here a few years ago. This is our native. They're only about the size of a golf ball. These guys get up the size of a baseball. So the big ones are the exotics. The small ones are the natives. The kites can eat them both. Look at how many eggs the exotics lay compared to our natives. Very different kind of thing. And most hawks, you know, when you drive down the highway, you see a hawk sitting alone on the wire. Kites seem to be kind of social, and they like to hang out with each other and even nest in aggregations. So a little bit unusual for birds. Okay, next. Okay, and this is just typical kite habitat. They live in the marshes, they live in the Everglades, they live in Lake Okeechobee. If this gets too thick, if it fills in with cattails, the snails and kites will leave. If it dries out, it'll kill all the snails because they're an aquatic snail. They live under the water. And the way the kites get them is they have to come up to the surface and breathe. And when they come up to get their little breathing tube to the surface, the kite sees them and plucks them out of the water. So they need kind of in between. They can't have hydroperiods that are real long. They can't have them that are too short. Next. This is where they occur. You can see just in Florida, there are some in Central America. We think these guys are a little bit different from these guys. They used to be all the way up to Jacksonville and the Panhandle, but nowadays, next, they're reduced to South Florida. And I'm going to point out some areas for you. This is the Everglades proper. This is Water Conservation Area 3. This is the most important area for kites. It's the biggest one. It can have the most kites in this part of the Everglades. The second one is Lake Okeechobee. It's the second largest area. It's second most important. And then up here in these lakes, these just have little thin bands of vegetation around the edges of them. So those are not very big areas, but they've been real important to kites lately. Next. This is Water Conservation Area 3A. This is the big area in the south. This is Everglades habitat. And you notice back in the 1990s, we had a lot of kites nesting. 60% were nesting down there. Notice in the last decade, they've really had trouble with water conservation areas. Next. And this is the number of young birds we've produced every year. And you notice back in the 1990s, we produced a whole lot. This was mostly down in water conservation areas. And in the last decade, we've not been making many babies. This is the number 100. We had a population of 3,500 birds just 12 years ago. Look at how few babies we've been putting out. Next. And here's what their population's doing. They've gone from 3,300 in about 1999 or 2000 down to about 700. This is a 75% decline. Very, very endangered bird right now. Next. So we'll talk about why. We'll talk about what we need to do to fix that. This is the hydrograph of WCA3. You notice something changed in the 1990s. Well, a couple things changed. We made management decisions. We were trying to protect Cape Sable Seaside Sparrows from flooding. And also we've gotten into a weather pattern that seems to be much more volatile than we used to have back in the 70s and 80s. We get wetter wets and drier dries. What happened to kites is the areas got so deep for so long that it wasn't good kite habitat anymore. Then we got some really bad droughts that dried everything out and killed all the snails. And once you kill all the snails, it takes several years for the snails to recover a population large enough for the kites to feed on them. So basically, the water's just been going crazy in WCA3. Next. And this is Lake Okeechobee, and this is the water levels during the 2000s. This red line is the desirable zone. You notice here's the hurricanes of 2000. We lost 40,000 acres of vegetation. Kites couldn't use the lake because we destroyed all the kite habitat. Then we had the really bad droughts in 2007 and 8. It dried out all the habitat. Kites couldn't use the lake again. And actually, after the 2008 event, just this year, we had about 40 kites try to nest on Okeechobee. But what did we have this spring? A drought. We pulled the water down, and most of the last 20 nests on the lake, we think only four of them might have made it. We know two of them made it. Two of them, we didn't get back to find out what happened. But basically, we just dried them out. So this is why the kites are tanking, is we can't control the water levels in either the Everglades or Lake Okeechobee. I'll talk about why next. Oh, yeah. These are the same. This is a hydrograph of Lake Okeechobee, and this is what it does nowadays, and that's what it used to do in the original Everglades. It only went up and down about 4 or 5 feet historically. Now it goes up and down 10 feet. Next. And this is why. It's us. We're people. This is the Consuming Prairie, and a drop of rain in the use of land out there used to, if you notice, there's no obvious drainage features, and water doesn't get off the land very fast. And so we have this real prominent wet season, and the whole Kissimmee Valley would fill up with water, and then over the next 8 months, that water would very gradually move down to Okeechobee, move down through the Everglades. Well, nowadays, we have these human-dominated habitats. This is a citrus grove. You can't see it. When water runs there, we get rid of it really quickly. And the way we do that is we built canals. And if you think about, what if this Miami Metroplex, what if we didn't have any freeways or highways? What if it was all just intersections and you drove block by block, stop sign by stop sign? How long would it take you to get around? Well, when you build canals, you're building freeways. You're building I-95. You're building a turnpike. And so water up here was in this place with no turnpikes. And once we built the Kissimmee River Canal, once we built all these other things, the water could get out of there really fast. And so now when water lands up in the north, we can drain the whole watershed in only 1 month, whereas it used to take 8 or 9. And so what happens to Okeechobee is essentially it gets 8 months' worth of water in only 1 month, makes it get really, really deep. And then, of course, the Corps gets scared about the dike. They dump all the water. And then when the dry season comes, we've already drained the watershed, so there's no water flowing into the lake, so it drops faster than it did historically. And, of course, we're using water for irrigation for cities, and so it drops even faster than it did historically. And that's why you get these really high highs and really low lows, and it's all related to our drainage of Florida. Next. And here's our superhighway map. This is the freeways. It's just us. And so what do we do? How do we make Florida okay for kites again? Next. Audubon wrote some reports. They're on our webpage. And this one was talking about Lake Okeechobee and the need to catch more water upstream. When it's wet, let's catch that water. Let's not make the lake get dangerously deep. And then when the drought starts, we're going to have water left over. It'll work better for both situations. Next. Just like in Okeechobee, we also think the Everglades Agricultural Area, we need to do more projects out there. And that's part of what, when the governor announced the River of Grass when he was trying to buy the U.S. Sugar Corporation stuff, that's what we're trying to do is when it's wet, we're going to put water somewhere where we can keep it till the drought. And this will help us moderate these water levels that we're seeing in Florida. Next. So until we get all these other projects done, this is Lake Toho. This is actually a relatively small lake. It's only about, I think, 30 square miles. But this is, these dots are all chitinous. And this was all aquatic plant treatment. They had an infestation with this exotic plant called hydrilla. And it just will choke off your lake. And what was happening is these kites were trying to nest, and we'd go out and kill this exotic. But then after you do it, and the kite was out there feeding on whatever's in the hydrilla, then there's nothing left because we just killed all the plants. And so kites were really having trouble. So we asked the agencies, please just limit your hydrilla control. And this is really weird for environmentalists because we showed up and we said, guys, you have an exotic plant that is hosting an exotic snail that's saving my endangered species. So I want you to protect my exotics. We don't like that, but until we can get the lower parts of the system fixed, we asked them to do that. And they did that this year, and they actually was very successful. Almost, I think, 75% of all the successful kite nests this year were up in this area, in the smallest area. Next? Okay, I'm about done. So we actually did have a bunch of nesting up there. They produced about 200 young. That's actually pretty good. We're very happy about that. Okeechobee and the WCAs didn't have very many. They still got these water level problems. So until we can fix that, we're going to try to keep this thing going. Next. So what do we do? We got to store more water. In the meantime, we're going to protect aquatic plants. We have some leeway in our water management decisions. The Corps of Engineers actually is working very hard to try to do as much for the kites as they can. And lastly, next. Oh, okay, good. that's not the style that was supposed to be, but it tells my point. See this? When Lake Okeechobee went down to here, we were in severe rationing, and the farmers were getting only 50% of the water they needed. They don't want the lake to go to 9 feet. I don't want the lake to go to 9 feet because this wipes out snail kites. And so I work for an environmental group, and people say, well, that's nice you work on birds, but I care about people. Guys, what we're trying to do to make Okeechobee work for kites is going to make Okeechobee work for farmers. Nobody wants the lake to fluctuate that wildly. And so until we build the storage, we can't protect kites, we can't protect our water supply. So this is all about, you know, the proverbial canary in the coal mine. So thank you.
Thank you, Paul Gray from Audubon. Our next speaker is Dr. Frank Mazzotti from the University of Florida, who's going to speak about alligators and crocodiles and other slimy things that hang out in the swamp. And by that, I don't mean TV journalists. I mean the actual native creatures. And you may have noticed Frank was used as a straight man in Gail Collins' column in the New York Times this week, which is hysterical. If you haven't seen that, go on the New York Times website and check it out. He's quoted in a very funny way. Okay, Frank, you are up.
Florida is the only... I don't think I'm going to need this. You can hear me in the back of the room,
I'm
sure.
No, we need you to speak in that, because they're recording it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, we need you to talk.
No wonder why it gets too loud then.
Yeah.
I'll bet you they can... Florida is the only place in the world where both alligators and crocodiles occur. This makes Florida unique. This is the one of the things that sets Florida apart from everywhere else. Alligators used to dominate the Everglades the way buffaloes dominated the Great Plains, both ecologically and culturally. Alligators meant to early settlers the same thing as buffaloes meant to Indians in the Great Plains. A little known fact about alligators: as the major source of fat for making soap during pioneer times in Florida was fat from alligators. It was the highest prized fat that you could do to make that item. American crocodiles are a federally listed species, and they represent the historical flow of fresh water to the Everglades. So if we get fresh water right for the Everglades, crocodiles should be able to tell us that. That's interesting Mackett adaptation of a PowerPoint slide. Alligators are, don't worry about it, I can tell. Alligators are keystone species. They are a keystone species because they create alligator holes in the Everglades. They are called ecological engineers for that. And they do that by creating holes where none exist or taking pre-existing holes and keeping them free of vegetation and sediment. This way, when the surrounding marsh dries down, water remains in the alligator holes. Other critters go into that alligator holes. They become food for alligators and become food for wading birds. And it's this cycle that characterized the Everglades and the drying of the Everglades, and the alligators made it happen. Alligators are considered a keystone species because their existence allows other species to exist in the Everglades that otherwise would not be able to. However, alligators in the Everglades are not doing well. There's a lot of stories out about how alligators are becoming more abundant and there's more interactions with humans in Florida. That's true, but not in the Everglades. It takes them longer to reach sexual maturity. They grow slower, they lay fewer eggs, but you can look at this one down here and you go, aha, there is something that Everglades alligators are better at than alligators elsewhere, how much mercury they have. So no matter how you look at it, alligators are not doing well in the Everglades, but again, it offers us something that we can look forward to in restoring this ecosystem, because their response to that should tell us whether or not we are being successful. Alligators are also skinnier in the Everglades than they are everywhere else. And a large male alligator of about 10 feet will weigh about 50 to 60% that an adult alligator will live in South Carolina. That's not good. That's the reason of that is because of the disrupted food supply, because we've disrupted the hydrology. And the same thing that keeps alligators from getting fat in the Everglades is also what prevents wading birds from nesting successfully. And that's okay. No, go ahead. Slightly different story for crocodiles. They are an endangered species success story. There are more crocodiles in more places now, and this includes some places where we don't want them. Crocodiles, as a result, were reclassified from endangered to threatened. However, we still have restoration issues for crocodiles because they grow slower. Like alligators do, they grow slower and survive less in the Everglades than they do in other areas. And so, again, this provides us a target for restoration. To restore crocodiles, there's a very close linkage between crocodiles and freshwater. Restoring freshwater to estuaries, the areas where salt and freshwater mix, will increase growth and survival of crocodiles. Very simple, very easy. It's easy for people to understand, and it's easy for us to measure. Go ahead. There are benefits to the comprehensive Everglades restoration plan and the programs along with that. Alligators and crocodiles are popular with the public. People like them. I think more people come to see alligators in Florida perhaps than any other critter, maybe except for Mickey Mouse. When people go into Everglades National Park, they stop at the entrance station and they go, where can I see an alligator? They don't ask for other species. People want to see alligators. We did a study in Florida to see how people react to the American crocodile. 75% of the people that we ask want more crocodiles in Florida, which is kind of a strange answer. You might not expect that, but people do. Now, of course, those are not people that have crocodiles in their backyards. We can integrate crocodiles with tools that we have for both evaluation and assessment of Everglades, and monitoring alligators and crocodiles is very cost effective. For a little more than a dime an acre, we can evaluate how successful Everglades restoration is. Except funding for monitoring of alligators and crocodiles has been completely eliminated from the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan budget for this year. And I think a good question for you guys to answer is why. I understand the budget being cut. Budget has to be cut for everything. But why completely eliminated an indicator that is so effective at telling us how the Everglades responds and is so popular with the public? One person said, well, it's because people want to see projects. They don't want to see alligators. I don't think anybody shows up in Everglades National Park and says, where can I see a project? people want to see alligators. Next. We now have a new iconic critter in Florida, the Burmese python. Burmese pythons in the Florida Everglades. Just doesn't sound right. The python gets to be 20 feet long and 200 pounds. This one you're looking at there was 14 feet long, weighed almost 140 pounds. Whatever your idea about snakes is before this, you see this animal and it is completely changed. Like them, don't like them, whatever you felt about it, you see this critter completely changes your perspective about them. They are part of the problem is they're incredibly cryptic. There are five pythons in this picture. Even if you got right up here, you couldn't see them. This was a nesting ball that we found by tracking a male with a radio transmitter, too. What you don't see here is the population growth of pythons. And from 1980, and I can draw this very easily, to 2010, it looks like that. There's been an exponential increase in pythons. Truly a cause for concern. Next. But here's the breaking news. It's just not pythons. This is a figure that shows species of reptiles and amphibians. The black are those that are introduced. That means they occur in Florida but are not yet breeding. The red ones are breeding. This is following the same pattern for the increase in individual pythons and that we are now hitting an exponential growth in new exotic invasive species becoming established in Florida. If we don't do something now, the only hope about this is risk assessment and early detection and rapid response. Because once you get to where we are with the problem with pythons today, your solutions are limited if you have them at all. Your only chance is early detection and rapid response. And this is not the end. We have removed over 100 Argentinian tegus from homestead this summer alone. Nile monitors are now present in South Florida. We recorded the first courtship ever of Nile monitors in Palm Beach County. Also found the first nest for tegus. Oustalet's chameleon, I was out doing this last night. We have captured and removed more than 100 Oustalet's chameleons from one avocado grove in Homestead. What's next? Thank you.
Thank you, Frank Mazzotti from the University of Florida. Our next speaker is, it's Matthew Schwartz, who is the Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. He's going to talk to us about perhaps the most endangered iconic critter we have, the Florida panther. Matthew?
I'm not manatees.
Manatees are slightly slower moving.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, just good. Mitch talks anyway. Let's have some fun.
That's right. That'll work.
Right. I see black and white. Let's see what happens there. Aha. Uh-huh. Cool. Slides, play. All right. That looks really good. Thank you. All right. So I'm not a scientist, not a biological scientist. My background is in the social sciences. My field work tends to be in offices of some of the people I see around me right now. I work with a lot of agencies. I work with a lot of politicians. The problems of the Florida panther are largely political and how we use the Florida landscape. Let's go on. So I took Journalism 101, and I remember the inverted pyramid, and I remember the most important thing, get it out first. If I stopped right here, this would be just about everything you need to know about the Florida panther. I'm going to read this. Florida panther, Puma concolor coryi. How did I do?
Coryi.
Coryi. Okay. I'm not good with my Latin. is an endangered, wide-ranging predator whose habitat needs conflict with a rapidly growing human population. That's it. That's the problem with the panther. This is a big cat. This is the, I'd say, in terms of length, third largest cat in the world. Tiger, lion, panther. The jaguar is bigger, size-wise stronger, but the panther is a big cat. This is from a famous piece called Kautz et al., How Much is Enough? Landscape Conservation for the Florida Panther. It gets quoted all the time. Next one. Okay, this is the original range. Now, the Florida panther, I'm not going to go into the genetics because there's a lot of controversy there. Essentially, the conclusion is the Florida panther is a mountain lion that got stuck in South Florida. And this is the original range. The mountain lion actually still goes from the Yukon all the way down to the tip of South America. Eastern United States, gone. It was declared extinct this year by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. No more cougars in the eastern United States. The sole remaining population is in the tip of South Florida. Next. Two pictures, mountain lion, panther. You can see that it's developed a few anatomical differences. We call that its Roman nose, high forehead. So it looks a little different than the mountain lion, but clearly it's considered a subspecies. There are some scientists that say, no, it's not even a subspecies. There's only one species of panther, cougar in the United States. The panther just has developed a few abnormalities. One difference I will say about the panther, it's never attacked a human being. Western cougars do attack people. And I think what happened was the word got out amongst the panthers that you got so little left, don't even think about attacking a person. Don't even consider it. Well, you're gone. Okay, next. Panther kittens, they start out spotted, blue eyes, good camouflage. They lose that at about 6 months. Look at the size of the paw, though, by the way. Even as a kitten, you can distinguish a panther kitten from a bobcat. Bobcat's a little bit bigger than a house cat. Panther kitten's paw print is much, much bigger. Uses those to catch prey. Got two big mitts. There's the original range of the Florida panther, all of the southeastern United States, but it would have mingled with other species all around it. Keep going. This is the man who they named the Florida panther from. This is the Coryi we were talking about, Charles Barney Coryi. And there was something about these gentlemen naturalists. They like to kill animals. Audubon loved to shoot birds. He shot many more birds than he needed to, by the way, way more. He just loved to shoot. And this guy shot a lot of panthers. This is Lake Worth. But panthers were all over the place at that time. And he did do a lot of scientific studies, specifically in birds, and killed a few panthers. Next. This is public land. So we say, what's the problem? I thought I might not have the PowerPoint. This is what South Florida looks like. A lot of people are very surprised to see a map like this. These are public lands. These are undeveloped lands. The 6 million people that live in South Florida live along this little tiny strip, 20 miles wide roughly, on the eastern coast. Another 300,000-400,000 live over here. The rest of it is public lands. Isn't that enough? Not exactly, and I'll show you why. Keep going. This is a satellite photo. Most of this is wet. Everglades National Park, 1.5 million acres, it does not support panthers. There are a few that kind of make a living in there looking for armadillos, possums, raccoons. Of course, they're eating pretty low on the food chain there and eating animals that do eat fish. They pick up mercury. The main panther habitat, you can see this forested area here. This is I-75 for those in South Florida. Runs along I-75, drops down into the Fakahatchee, the Picayune. This is the heart of panther habitat, what the Fish and Wildlife Commission here calls the inverted L. It's not all of South Florida. Keep going. And here you could see, this is based on telemetry. About a third of the panthers are collared. These are actually telemetry markings. And you can see very clearly how it just runs in this little tiny strip along I-75, down along the Fakahatchee, spreads out around here. Panthers are solitary animals. They're not pack animals. When a panther gets about 2 years old, it's got to establish its own territory. Males will not tolerate other males in their habitat, and they will fight. They will fight to the death. That's called intraspecific aggression. It's becoming one of the leading cause of death for Florida panthers. It's obviously, the leading cause of death, what do you think? Roadkill. I wonder how many cars with the license plate, Protect the Panther, have run over panthers. I always think about that sometimes with any statistics. But at any rate, sometimes the males will start going out. The males will start dispersing and looking for new habitat. And they do go across the Caloosahatchee River. Sometimes they're up in Orlando. Sometimes they're mucking around Disney World. They don't last very long up there. But we do get roadkill up there as well. At any rate, it's a very small habitat that supports this population. Keep going. Why a Florida? Let's go to the next one. It'll be a little clearer in the next one. This is a dark sky map of the United States, fairly recent. What do you see? There's one dark splotch in South Florida. That's the reason why panthers are in South Florida. There's nothing special about the swamps of South Florida. As I said, the panthers live in the live from the Rocky Mountains to the Amazon to the Yucatan to the Southwest. They're in South Florida because it's the last piece of undisturbed land in the eastern United States, and it's going quickly. And that's what I do most of my work around. Keep going. This is just a timeline. We'll just go through this. This is Eastern Collier County. This is a project called the Rural Land Stewardship Program, which tries to create these corridors and allows developments to happen alongside of those corridors. That's the current strategy being used to protect the panther. We'll develop this. We won't develop this. Hopefully, that will leave enough land for the panther. Let me show you the impact of that. Next one. This is the community of Ave Maria, created by the... I think it was Domino's Pizza. Yeah. Domino's Pizza Magnet created this community out here. Nobody's living out there. It's actually
Catholic
kind of a
university built by an Irish pizza maker.
Nobody's living there. Publix actually said, we're not going in there. And then the developer said, you know what? We'll build you a Publix, okay? Just bring the food in. Because that's how few people are living out here. This is smack in the middle of panther habitat. This is Oil Well Road that goes out here. I'm going to give you an example of the kind of policy that I deal with. This was built directly over a major panther corridor, this out here, this is Camp Keys Strand. When the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did their biological opinion, that's the permitting process. They have to approve a project and say, this is okay for the panther. What they say is, every time they say the same thing. This is not good for the panther. However, no critical habitat exists, and that's true. The panther itself is protected. However, there is no critical habitat. The habitat is not fully protected. Therefore, none will be impacted. And then the conclusion, it was almost laughable. They said, well, 6 lanes shouldn't bother a panther any more than 2 lanes. It has nothing to do with the width of the highway. It's how much it gets used. Next slide. This is showing panther telemetry going right across the project area, going up into the Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. Down here is the Panther National Wildlife Refuge. This corridor is used heavily to connect the areas. Next slide. This is what a 6-lane highway looks like. This is what I say. I don't know whether this is a joke or what, but panthers do die on this highway, and they do try to, unfortunately, there's not much west of it anymore. Whatever's left is to the east of here. This is Collier Boulevard in the greater Naples area. Next one. Let's go on through this. This is the Big Cypress National Preserve. This is where 63%. Roughly of the habitat is right in this preserve right here. The best of it, as I said, is north of I-75. This area here is the addition lands. There's litigation going on. A couple of lawsuits coming up on this piece of land right here. I'll show you what's going on there. This is the preserve right now. These three areas currently are closed to off-road vehicles and motorized hunting. And this big piece here, as I said, is the 146,000-acre addition lands. The National Park Service decided in November of 2010 Let's bring motorized hunting into this area. Now, obviously, they've done their studies. It's 187. Their last survey showed 187 deer in the Big Cypress, and they've decided that this is the proper use. In order to create greater diversity of use, we're going to open this area up to motorized hunting. That's supposed to happen pretty soon. This is the impacts that motor vehicles do. This is a stabilized trail. This is an area where people have just mucked up the soil. The off-road vehicles spread invasive species throughout the area. For some of the smaller critters in the preserve, in fact, the graduate student working under Dr. Mazzotti showed that these trails are no man's land, fragment the habitat tremendously. Keep going. This is the last example I'm going to give you. This is the Florida Power and Light County Clean Energy Center. This is the latest brainchild of FP&L to create the largest fossil fuel power plant in the world, in the United States anyway, right here. This is the Big Cypress Preserve, created right over here. Let's go to the next slide. I'll show you what's going on there. So this piece of land was attempted to be acquired. It was supposed to be part of Panther Glades to connect habitat in the north to the Big Cypress. And now it is becoming something else completely. Next slide. Could you get through there? Okay. So this is the area. These are collared panthers, by the way. These are collared male panthers.
Yeah, you got 1 minute, man.
Okay. And you can see that this area right over here, heavily used by collared panthers. Heavily used by collared panthers. Why would FP&L choose this area to put the biggest power plant in the country? I don't know. Keep going. This is another set of collared panthers in the area. Next one. And here you can see, these are examples. These yellow dots, each one of these refer to intraspecific aggression. Each one of these yellow dots is a place where a panther died as a result of a fight with another panther. They're putting the Clean Energy Center right in the middle of habitat that's already being fought over by panthers. Next one. This is roadkill in South Florida. Each yellow dot refers to roadkill. So you can see the basic problem that I said in the very beginning, that the biggest problem for the Florida panther is habitat. We want it. They want it. They can't go to court. I unfortunately have to go to court constantly to do this. And that's pretty much what I spend my life doing, is talking to agencies, litigating these projects, raising money for lawsuits, trying to bring other people in to work on it for me. We don't vote on these projects. These projects just happen. What's the last slide? Keep going. Well, this is the twin of what they're trying to build. And they're saying this is compatible. They're going to work around it. They say, well, we'll develop here. We won't develop there. This is the basic model of what we have in store for us. This is a powerful company. This is a company that makes $1 billion a year profit, and I make a few thousand. So I'm going to wrap up there. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. That was Matthew Schwartz, Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association. Next up is Pat Rose, who is the Executive Director of the Save the Manatees. And by the way, we have a little bit of an environmental royalty in the room with us. Fabien Cousteau is here. Can you just wave to everybody? Thanks for being here, Fabien. Go ahead, Pat.
Okay, I know we're running short on time, so I'm not going to give you, obviously, the history of manatees in 10 minutes, but I hope to at least give you enough that you want to ask questions later, either here or follow up. And like the Goliath groupers, we thought we'd throw in a little sex into the program. So right off the bat, if you couldn't tell, that's the female. All these are other males, and what you don't see in this, there's about another 15 outside of this group of the smaller males. So, and that's one of the things manatees are doing really great, and they have always done great, is they've made it. And they have, next slide, please. They get incredibly pregnant. This is a manatee at Blue Spring, and I could literally see the fetus kicking inside of her. And 2 days after this picture was taken, she gave birth to a manatee. Go to the next one. Oh, back one, I'm sorry. Too quick. And of course, they have their young, generally one, sometimes twins, and they nurse them behind the one of each of their front flippers. They would have a mammary gland there. Next slide. I'm cutting through a lot of that pretty quick. Just before I talk about what's really going on with manatees, I thought I'd at least show you what the total mortality, which is the red line on top, and this is since records really being kept since 1974, and on the bottom is the watercraft mortality. The interesting enough, of course, those spikes that go way up, the last spike that you see there, that's the incredible winter mortality that we had in 2010. We've also lost about over 100 in 2011, so we're not done. We're already just about breaking the 400 line now in terms of total mortality this year. If we don't have a cold winter, we don't have too many more boat strikes, we may just hit around that 400. But even so, you can see that's at the peak without those outliers. The other spikes are issues like red tide and cold and so forth. Next slide. I will take just a little time on this slide because this kind of is one slide to tell you what is and isn't happening. There was a risk and threats analysis done in 2007 using a biological core model, a lot of science put together and all the different factors. It basically showed that while manatees have been doing better and the population has been growing, they're still at really high risk of extinction at that point in time in 2007. And in fact, one of the outcomes was that there was a 26% chance that the population on either coast falling below 500 individuals in 50 years. So we're looking at the long term, and with manatees, we have to look at the long term. If you were to take a snapshot today and look at what the population probably had been doing since its lowest around the first part of the 19th century, we may have only had a few hundred manatees then. We have about 4,500 to 5,500 manatees now. So that sounds like really good news, and it is good news. The problem is whether we can sustain it or not, and that has a lot to do with politics, and that will be kind of where I get into. But so that model is being revised now. The adult survival ship for manatees has actually done better since 2007, except that it hasn't incorporated these catastrophic losses of manatees due to cold. So even this next round we get may not have those numbers in it. So what does it mean? it means what it means without the catastrophic losses, which, of course, tells us this population is still very vulnerable to weather events and those kinds of things. And so therefore, watercraft and cold are the two primary factors that manatees continue to face and can have catastrophic consequences. Watercraft over time can prevent or cause declines. The cold can take very quick, rapid reductions in the population. And in fact, the cold we've experienced there has been is over 10% of the current population. The last line I'll mention here is when you look at the rate that Florida is rolling back its environmental protections, the federal government won't be able to rely on Florida's laws. Just if any of you spent time thinking about what's been happening in Florida, we have really, for all intents and purposes, no growth management laws anymore or an agency to manage those. Our water management districts have been decimated financially and in terms of their staffs, and basically you have the foxes guarding the hen house now in terms of the board members. I'm probably being kind in saying it that way. You look at any law in Florida right now that has to do with the environment or quality of life, and it's being stripped away, both in terms of the actual law, but also in terms of the money it's going to take to implement those laws that remain. Next slide. I want to just touch on, I'm not showing you any dead manatees today. I don't have to, I don't think, to show you. There's very few manatees that haven't been hit by boats, that haven't been scarred tremendously or lost large portions of their, you know, tails and so forth. It's there. They're incredibly resilient, though, in that they're surviving these things. Next slide. I wish this were clear, but this is part of the Crystal River case I want to talk to you about. It's happening right now, and it defies really logical understanding. This is a high-speed boat here, high-speed boat here. All these things looking like crab track buoys, these are all divers' heads. And they're out there looking at the manatees in the summertime when, in the winter, this is a slow-speed zone to protect manatees as a refuge in the winter. In the summertime, it becomes a 35-mile-per-hour water sport zone. And it's been killing manatees regularly over the past several years. At the time the compromise was put in 92, I did it. I was working for the state of Florida managing those programs. But there were very few manatees in the summertime in Kings Bay, and there were very few boaters. Subsequent to that, it's become, the population has done better there, and it is growing, but the risk, the threats, and the deaths have gone way up, and they're going to continue to do so. And, of course, it's not just manatees at risk. It's people, too. Next slide, please. You won't be able to read this with a small, but it's a cover letter from the city administrator for the city of Crystal River, basically transmitting this unanimous resolution asking for the water sports zone to be taken away and replaced by a slow speed zone year round. And they're reminding them that this is the second time they're asking for it, and they want to make sure that they do it. And it was based upon a waterways board's months and months of meetings, looking at the science, looking at the boating safety, the history, and all those things. And they asked for this in 2007, and they subsequently followed up for many years asking for it. You wonder, why am I showing you this? It'll become evident. Next. Of course, that's just the signature. Well, Fish and Wildlife Service finally did get around to responding, and now they're proposed a rule to do everything the local government asked them to do. You'd think that would make the local government happy, especially, let's go back to that one, especially if you look at the actual official public record of comments that came in response to this rule. There were 105,000 people saying that responded, of which all but about 227 were for the rule, emphatically for it. So nationwide, locally, what have you, there were a few Crystal River people against it, 72. Next slide, please. And that would all be in keeping with a unanimous resolution by the city government and so forth. That's not what's happening. Tea Party gets involved in this issue. Suddenly now manatees are against the Constitution and and part of a, you know, Agenda 21 and part of an international conspiracy to treat people like livestock. I won't get into all of it, but you get the flavor. Craig Pittman wrote a wonderful story on that.
1 minute 10.
That's just all pretty recent. So now, 2 days ago, City of Crystal River, they want to sue because the Fish and Wildlife Service gave them what they asked for, to protect the manatees, to protect the people. But now with the change in climate there, everything the federal government's doing has got to be bad. It's bad for the, it's against the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. I'm mocking it a bit, but this is what's really happening. They shifted from a total unanimous support, and even three of the city councilmen are the same ones, now threatening to get people fired and suing them. Next slide, please. Well, I'm at the end pretty much of, I was going to go on and talk about different species of sirenians. And of course, we lost the stellar sea cow in, 28 years from the time it was found and hunted and for meat and because of in the Bering Sea area. Next slide, and then I want to come back to this one. And we have three species of manatees. The Florida manatee is a subspecies of the West Indian manatee. I'm talking a little fast because I want to save maybe a couple of questions for it. This is the range of the West Indian manatee, the Amazonian manatee, and the West African manatee. These are where you have dugong populations. This is the extinct habitat of the stellar sea cow. Now go back one slide. That's a manatee. It's not a dugong. You know, a dugong has a tail like that, but that's basically a manatee in Crystal River, just another one of the manatees that have been hit and mutilated. And so with that, I hope maybe I've encouraged you to think there's more about it. There's a lot of good going on, but there's a lot of craziness going on with manatees, and their future is certainly not secure. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Pat Rose of the Save the Manatee Foundation. We have a little less than 15 minutes for questions. Sarah, do you want to come back up here? If you have any group or sex questions, let's keep it low so we don't, so as not to offend our room next door. So any questions from the audience? Yes, Mr. Cousteau.
You know, I'm going to ask you, sir. When you said that populations are not likely to come back to their original numbers, what did you mean by that?
Let me just reiterate the question. The question was, when you said they're not,
yeah,
the populations
so
aren't supposed to aren't likely to come back, what did you mean?
They're not
by
supposed
that?
To come back, likely to come back to where they were before the commercial extinction began, and. In Florida specifically. This comes from a number of studies. The most striking study was completed by Jeremy Jackson from Scripps Institute of Oceanography and presented at the International Marine Conservation Congress this last May. And they were doing historical ecology, and they reconstructed how many goliath groupers used to be here from the 1900s until now. And putting things in perspective, the supposedly spectacular recovery we have had in goliath grouper, it shows us a very tiny, tiny bump in the history of the population of goliath grouper. The reason is because goliath groupers need two types of critical habitat. They need the mangroves as juveniles. They need the reefs as adults. And these two habitats are the most endangered right now in Florida. Even though you are not supposed to cut down mangroves, the water quality, the water flowing through the mangroves, the quality gets lower and lower every day. Same thing goes for the coral reefs. That's the reality. So in terms of habitat, you're not going to have the habitat you used to have in the 1900s. It's not going to happen. So the numbers won't get up that high ever. But also goliath groupers, they are susceptible to catastrophic mortality events. When you have red tides and you have major fish kills, the adult goliath groupers, that is the big mamas and the papas, they die in spectacular numbers. When you have cold water events like the winters we had in 2009 and 2010, those kill pretty much 90% of the juvenile population in the mangroves of the 10,000 islands and the Florida Keys. That means 8-year classes were wiped out of the surface of the planet when it comes to goliath grouper. To make a similarity in humans, it will be equivalent to have all the kids in the United States, all the kids that are from first to eighth grade suddenly dying from something catastrophic. That will be the equivalent in our species.
Wow.
How do you recover from that? That's the situation we're in right now.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Yeah, this has been a great, great panel. Thanks to all of you. Sarah, I was struck by when you said that what goliath grouper actually scientifically eat. I am an old manatee guy over Pat, and the power of anecdote and rumor seems to always be one-sided. It never seems to work for us, but it always seems to kind of work for the other side. And I was wondering if everybody could maybe talk about the impact of kind of anecdotes, that boaters, fishermen, other folks tend to have, and the power that has on policymaking. Because I think I've even heard Fish and Wildlife commissioners in Florida who are appointed reiterate that.
purposes of the recording, the question is, does the power of anecdotal stories and myths and rumors impact the survival of the species that we're talking about?
As a marine biologist, I study animal behavior, and we're all animals, so I'm going to apply what I've learned from studying animal behavior. And I've discovered that in our species, if you repeat a lie many, many times, it becomes truth in the collective consciousness. So the old-time fishermen, the guys that have been here for a long time, they know what the Goliath groupers eat. They know what the manatees eat. They know their species. And I just want to think that the ones that are blaming Goliath groupers for everything is probably out of misinformation, that there's no malice on it, though recent events have convinced me otherwise. But what I'm trying to do as a scientist, I try to reach out to fishermen, reach out to divers, and explain how things are really. I come with the facts. I show them. Sometimes I pull things out of the stomachs of Goliath groupers, and I show them, look, this is what they're eating. And to my surprise, even with this hardcore evidence, you still have people that deny the evidence and deny the truth.
Sarah,
so
Pat,
just keep working at it. Just be
Pat
perseverant.
Pat wants to address that as well.
Yeah, I think it's endless the way that they will misrepresent. They'll look for any angle that they can. And I know with the manatee issues, I'm on about my 40th year of it. And we started and had to dismantle the belief that the marine industry spoke for boaters. They don't. And we did studies to show they didn't. And then they moved to the next one. And then they talked about economic impact and loss to regulations and to property values. We did, peer-reviewed studies showed, in fact, it was the opposite, that you actually increase private property in those areas where the manatee regulations were. And you have to keep coming back at it. You can't let them get by with it because they will say it enough and enough. There's one point I wanted to make about the manatees and specifically, and I think it's very true about the Everglades from a geographical standpoint, but manatees, you heard about keystone species, you've heard before about flagship species. I have coined a term for manatees, it's the tugboat species, because it literally, we've had to look at it as a species to pull along the ecosystem, aquatic ecosystem protections, and to really fight against a lot of these lies and mythology that go into development and what's bad for developments, therefore it's got to be bad for you and your pocketbook and all that. And what Jerry said is very true, and we'll never be able to be relaxed. We'll have to always demonstrate and keep putting before the people the value, because even when the state of Florida was trying to overhaul its endangered species or imperiled species system, they were downgrading it across the board. They were devaluing all imperiled species. There was one species that stood up and held that line, and the people rallying behind it, and it was the manatee. When they went to prematurely downlist the manatee, we rallied enough people in there, but we didn't say we'll cut a deal for manatees. We said it's got to be done for all imperiled species. And, in fact, one of the commissioners then said, well, I don't know how I can vote against it. It's like voting against Santa Claus. And in a sense, that's great, but it's also like, well, they don't deserve it, but we'll give it to them anyway because they, they just didn't want to do one more lie. It is constant. It's going to be with us, but I literally want to work it in. Remember tugboat species, because there's a lot being protected today in our aquatic habitats throughout Florida that are there because of manatees and because of the support of manatees. So even when we're looking at debating the issue of downlisting them again, the science looks quite good. But when you look at the future and the stability and those laws having to stay in place and be effective into the future, how fast can we lose those laws? And again, just look at Florida right now and what we're headed through.
Any other questions for any panelists?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, your name is
Pat. Yes.
I was just in Crystal River filming the manatees. I found a great deal of the local public divided on the issue of manatees.
Mm-hmm.
One half say they're a pest,
right,
because they're getting in their way of voting, and the other half are protecting them, to nowhere. There's a huge industry there, and what I found is the actual manatees, because they are such a slow and approachable animal, it's a very easy human connection.
Right.
I think the local dive industry are really pushing that hard to try and create connection by actually supporting the touching of manatees as long as it doesn't disturb their natural behavior. If they come over by curiosity, then they allow some sort of interaction.
And what I would say is I agree there's an awful lot to that. In fact, again, one of my previous positions.
The point made was that manatees are very curious, and in some areas, the gentleman was speaking of Crystal River, the dive industry is trying to capitalize on that by allowing divers to interact with them. Is one of your points, is that good for the animal?
Not if it's good for the animal. I think that what they're doing is protecting, one, their industry and the natural habitat of the manatee by in their own way, policing interaction.
That, and what I'll say is that's where we've taken it to. It started out being fairly innocent, and then it got overwhelmingly bad. But we've been working steady for 6 years with the industry. They have responded. There are a lot of those folks that are understanding that it is literally the cash cow or the goose that lays the golden egg.
The cash sea cow, as it were.
Yes, exactly. And so they've come a long ways. And, in fact, there's a new organization formed by those groups together. And they did support the slow speed zone throughout the bay. They've supported stronger restrictions on them to help prevent harassment because they know it's within their best interest to do that. I happen to be a paddy instructor and underwater photographer and so forth, and so I have a lot of affinity with that. And I officially kept those areas open when I was the federal coordinator for manatee programs because of that fact, to build that affinity among those groups. And it does work so long as it doesn't go overboard.
Well, that's at the moment, that's what I've
right.
seen. In the winter months, we've got up to 75 craft on a weekend, all plugged into a couple hundred square meters, vying for space, some with tour operators, that are trying to do the right thing. Others would just be able to hire a boat and plug in there, and they don't really
yes.
know what's going on. So there's this kind of mess. And meanwhile, in a cold winter, all the manatees that are sitting there, they're actually just trying to sleep.
Exactly.
They're trying to sleep their way through it. And much like captive dolphins, they're being treated in some way of, you know, first thing they want to do is to wake up in the morning and deal with 100 people.
Right.
You know, that are just...
And that's where this new rule, I didn't talk about those points, sets up many more sanctuaries, places where the divers cannot go into, and then and rules about how that's done, what distance they can approach at, and there's a lot of more technical things that should find more of a balance. But no, manatees have been harassed senseless over there, but it's getting better, and it will get better because we are gaining the cooperation of those involved with it.
Any other questions?
I'd just like to add something real quick. This is the issue of ecotourism, diving to see the big animals and so forth. You always have to remember that an ecotourist is a predator. An ecotourist is a predator. It's a benign predator because it's not intending to kill the animal, but it's a predator anyway. To the wild animal, it looks like a predator. Something is coming to me. What is it going to do to my baby? What is it going to do to me? So every time there's ecotourism going on, there should be a code of conduct on how to do the ecotourism activity without disturbing the animal. And that's a completely new, different story.
I have to say, though, that the operators are extremely diligent in educating you as to what a manatee is going to see when they see the water. And that education, I think, makes the whole difference for the actual interaction.
Well,
it makes, I think, that interaction will turn someone that has absolutely no care for the environment into suddenly starting to wonder.
It's just like seeing animals in a zoo. They make that point all the time. You gain an affinity for the animals,
exactly.
And hopefully that helps you in the wild protect them.
In a zoo, it's the wrong education.
Right.
It's just like with captive dolphins, the wrong education. It's not actually in the natural state.
Well, we have this problem with snail kites on Lake Toho. It's right next to Tana Kissimmee, which is Disney. The airboat operators want to go nature tours to go see the kites, and the kites are trying to nest. And residents around the lake don't like airboats, and so there's this whole conflict between trying to have people see them and not disturb everybody else, and it happens.
I'm afraid that has to be the last word. I've been told that I have to break this up at 3:15 sharp. If you want to ask any of our panelists questions, feel free to do so. I'm sure they're going to hang around. And I've been told to ask you all to go into the dining room right over here, the big ballroom over here, after the panel is done. Thank you all for coming. Let's have a hand for our panelists because they were awesome.